Chapter 4. There was much work to be done. With blacklight protocols lifted, the warriors and crew of the Avenger could direct their efforts towards the consolidation of their strength. The hasty rearmament and reorganization after Istvan were superseded by more deliberate measures. Ad hoc squads were broken up and reformed. Legionaries were promoted to sergeants, and sergeants raised to higher ranks still. Amongst those who were busiest were the remaining handful of legionaries from the Armorium. The Raven Guard had lost most of their equipment during the long hit-and-run battles of Istvan V, and to the Tech Marines now fell the task of ordering and repairing and restocking the war gear of the reconstituted squads. The Avengers' holds gave up a great store of ammunition, but new power armor and weapons were insufficient for the 2,500 legionaries on board. Armor replacements and spare parts were also at a premium. And so, along with his fellow Tech Marines, Straden Binalt spent much of his time working on the guns and armor the Raven Guard had salvaged from their defeated foes. His existence became a blur of work, every waking hour filled with the crackle of arc welders, the smell of livery paint, the squeal of pneumatic ratchets, and the heat of ceramite kilns. Binalt was intrigued by the war gear that he came across, some of it very familiar, some of it of radically different design, issued to other legions from dozens of forge worlds across the Imperium. As best he could, he cobbled together repairs for the Mark IV suits of armour worn by the majority of his comrades, bastardising pieces from the older Mark II and III suits taken from the bodies of word-bearers, iron warriors, and world-eaters. Nothing was perfect, and every patch and jury-rig came only with the assurance that it would last a battle or two, should the Avenger encounter the enemy again before reaching Terra. There was little enough aboard the Avenger to work with, so compromises had to be made. Most of the Legion's armoured vehicles had been destroyed or abandoned at the Urgal Plateau, so spare parts for tanks and transports were not in short supply. Binalt and his fellow Tech Marines devised a way to reinforce the armour they had created, using the molecular bonding studs usually employed for affixing armour and ablative plates to rhinos and predators. This gave the suits a particular appearance, the shoulder guards sealed with a row of large rivets that looked like nodules or blisters. Other vehicle parts, transmission cabling, servos, even spare track links, were pressed into service as makeshift components for the new armour design. Slowly, the legionaries started to look like Raven Guard again. Greaves, plastrons, shoulder guards and van braces that had sported the colours of all the legions that had fought on Istvan were painted in the black of the Raven Guard, insignia lovingly applied, each stroke of brush or sweep of spray obliterating the colours of former friend and foe alike, as if the Legion were cleansing itself of the memories by covering their marks with their own livery. Spare time was in short supply, and in the few breaks he had, Binalt contemplated another, more personal project. He had secured himself a small space between two of the starboard gun towers, a noisy little chamber that reverberated with the clank of the autoloaders and drummed with the feet of the crew as they performed their gun drills, ever ready for battle. There was room only for a small worktop and a set of shelves, no chair for Binalt, so he stood instead. The Tech Marine looked at the large pile of broken parts gathered on the table and wondered where he would begin. Pieces of shattered ceramite and twisted metal sat under nuts and bolts and a nest of wires and cables. Here and there he could identify a servo or actuator or muscle-like fibre bundle, all systems he was used to dealing with in a suit of power armour, but fashioned in a way he had never encountered elsewhere. He admired the beauty of the craftsmanship, even as he marvelled at the engineering and design that had been laboured upon the haphazard scattering of pinions and power relays. Binalt started by sorting through all of the parts, splitting them into piles by form and function, leaving some aside whose purpose he had not yet divined. Day by day, sometimes snatching only a few minutes at a time when others were gratefully taking their allotted few hours of rest, he began to make sense of the mess. Alone with his thoughts, bringing rational observation to emotions thrown into disorder by recent events, he contemplated the nature of the daunting project he had chosen to undertake, and broke it down into achievable goals. It was relaxing in an odd way, removing the Tech Marine from the clutter of the Legion and the memories of Istvan, a perfectly self-contained sphere in which he could operate, with definable outcomes all within his control. It would be a long time until he was finished, perhaps longer than he would survive. But Binhart was determined, filled with a need to do this particular work of artifice. If he could complete this, the world would be right again, and his existence would make sense once more. There was little to do except drill, eat, and rest. The Avenger had translated from Istvan 70 days ago, and the warp storms were making progress slow. Alpharius worked with his squad each day, learning more about them, and more about the person he was supposed to be. He had heard rumours that they were not going to Deliverance, but were en route to Terra. The thought intrigued, excited, and worried him in equal measure. He had never been to Old Earth, and for many years had aspired to do so. Before the twin Primarchs had commanded that the Legion back Horus, Alpharius had often quizzed the older Alpha Legionnaires about the world of mankind's birth. None of them had been back since they had embarked upon the Great Crusade, and certainly none of them had truly believed that they would ever again witness the glory of the Imperial Palace. Alpharius knew that his loyalties were now to a different cause, but the thought of being close to the Emperor still sent a thrill through him, matched only by the pleasure he had experienced on being singled out by the true Alpharius for this mission. The Primarch had taken him into his confidence and explained the nature of the Legion's change of allegiance. The Emperor had, perhaps unwittingly, betrayed his sons and their legions. He had abandoned them, and in turn had allowed the Great Crusade to falter. The Primarch could not explain why this had happened, but had been adamant that Horus would set mankind back on the path of the Imperial truth. Alpharius wondered if he would get a glimpse of the Emperor, and then fretted that if he were brought into the Imperial presence, his duplicitous nature might be revealed. Surely, a man as gifted as the Master of Mankind would not be fooled by an altered face and name change. More than that, Alpharius's guise was Terran-born. What if the others born of Terra, only a handful left after the massacre but still alive nonetheless, saw some flaw in his disguise? What if he betrayed his lack of knowledge to the other Terrans? There was little time to worry about the future. Alpharius had to stay constantly alert to maintain the facade he had adopted. He was fortunate in one sense. His new self had a reputation for being taciturn, and this meant he was not expected to speak much. With the help of the apothecaries and the material absorbed by his amophagere, his vocal cords and mouth had been reshaped to better resemble that of the legionary whose identity he had assumed. But to the keen ears of a space marine, any small difference might give rise to suspicion. His greatest defence, shared by the others he hoped had also succeeded in their infiltration, was in the unlikelihood of what the Alpha Legion had done. Why would any Raven Guard suspect that their foes had taken on the faces of the fallen? It was a wonderful machination by the Primarch, and so characteristic of his genius. For another legionary to have doubts about Alpharius's true nature was to invite thoughts of paranoia. It was so improbable that any suspicion without good evidence was likely to be dismissed out of hand. Alpharius bent his mind to ensuring there would be no evidence, training and eating and sleeping alongside his adopted legion. He showed pride as his ragtag armour was replaced, speaking words of vengeance and swearing oaths of loyalty to the Emperor and Lord Korax alongside his new brothers-in-arms while they repainted their icons. There had been a few occasions when Alpharius had come close to revealing himself. Each day he learned a little more, small mannerisms, turns of phrase, and legion protocols that enabled him to blend in better with his fellow legionaries, but it was not a perfect process. His latest close call had come during a hand-to-hand combat drill. The company had gathered in one of the hangar bays amongst the dormant shapes of Thunderhawks and Stormbirds, the Avengers' dedicated training chambers being insufficient for the large number of warriors on board. Sergeant Dor had called the squad to order and given a disturbing speech. "We must learn to fight a new enemy," he had told them. "For decades we have honed our skills against savages and inferior foes and faced strange adversaries such as the Istvan War Singers and the Ninturnian Devil Blades. Now we face something entirely different. Now we must fight other space marines." It was an obvious thing to say, but having the situation mentioned so boldly brought home to the legionaries just how much the galaxy had changed. There were mutters of discontent, but Alpharius held his tongue, not wishing to betray his own thoughts on the matter. We train against each other every day, Luca had said. What difference should we expect? We have never tried to kill each other, had been the sergeant's reply. The squad had paired off, armed only with their monomolecular-edged combat blades. Alfarius had found himself facing Luca, and the two of them had started at the sergeant's command, thrusting and parrying, trying to find the weak points in each other's armour, probing for the flexible joint seals, reinforced eye lenses, and the gaps between armour plates. Blades flickering, other pairs duelling around them, Luca and Alfarius were a match for each other, equal in speed and strength. Their blades clanged against each other, were caught on shoulder guards or deflected by angled movements of their forearms, neither able to find an opening. It was then that Alfarius had made his mistake. Feinting high, he had dropped to one knee as Luca's blade had shot up to meet the blow. Under his opponent's guard, Alfarius had reversed his grip on the knife and swung backhanded, driving its point towards the vulnerable sliver of material between Luca's upper thigh armour and his groin guard. Luca had frozen. Alfarius's blade just millimetres from contact. "You have me," declared Luca, stepping back, shaking his head. There was surprise in his voice. "Where did you learn such a move?" Alfarius had hesitated, realizing that the manoeuvre had been part of his Alpha Legion training, not replicated in the doctrine of the Raven Guard. "I saw a traitor using it at the drop site," Alfarius had said quickly. "I watched a word-bearer take out one of our brothers from the salamanders with that move." The rest of the squad had stopped their drills and were looking at Alfarius and Luca. Alfarius did not like being the centre of attention. He had stood up and sheathed his blade. A sergeant door approached, helmeted head, cocked to one side. "What was that?" the sergeant had asked. "Using the tactics of the traitors?"
"It seemed effective at the time," Alfarius had replied, remaining calm.
"Pay attention," Dor had said, waving the rest of the squad closer. "Why don't you show us that again?"
Alfarius did as he was asked, demonstrating the undercutting blow to the others. There were murmurs of appreciation, and Dor had slapped him on the chest with a word of thanks.
"This is what we must do," the sergeant had said.
The red of his eye plates had seemed to fix on Alfarius for some time before he continued, moving his gaze to the rest of the squad.
"We need to learn from our enemies. Adapt to the way they will fight. Any other innovations, any edge you can give us, share with the rest? All right?"
"Yes, Sergeant," Alfarius had replied.
Though his cover had remained intact, it was later that same day that Alfarius had realized what he had done. One day, a Raven Guard might use that move on an Alpha Legionnaire, or defend himself against it, and so be victorious. Alfarius's purpose was to learn about the Raven Guard, not enhance their skills. The situation was getting more complicated than he had imagined, the considerations more numerous. Alfarius focused on what was important. He was an actor, playing a part, learning more about his role with every day. In his heart, he knew he was sworn to the Alpha Legion and felt no guilt at lying to those who he had once called his allies. It was not their fault that they had chosen the wrong side in the coming war. Alfarius did not feel contempt or pity for the Raven Guard, but had only a mild sense of regret that he could never genuinely call the legionaries around him brothers again. Their names slipped from his tongue as easily as the false declarations of allegiance and revenge, but he was not one of them. Like the rest of the Alpha Legion, he had been chosen for a greater purpose, one that the twin primarchs had assured him went beyond loyalty to the Emperor or Horus and concerned the fate of the galaxy itself. And like all of those who are blind to the greater truth, the Raven Guard were expendable. They would serve their part and then be destroyed, and he would be returned to his legion to fight amongst his true battle brothers again. It was this thought, this goal, that focused Alfarius as he lay awake, pondering the unknown task ahead. He was Alpha Legion, and so did not expect to be lauded or singled out. Such glory-mongering was not in the Legion's traditions. He would fulfill his purpose, take contentment from the knowledge of a mission accomplished and the praise of his twin primarchs, and become one of the many again. From a gallery overlooking one of the impromptu mess decks that had once been a live firing range, Korax looked down at several companies of his Raven Guard, filling themselves with ship's rations. They stood at long trestle tables. Chairs were another scarce commodity on board, and diligently ate from platters laden with synthetic meat and dry soy bread. The fare was tasteless, but rich in the proteins and carbohydrates the legionaries needed to sustain themselves. Nutrient supplements were imbibed in the form of fortified water, drunk straight from crude jugs, turned out by the serfs in the lower deck workshops.
"How are our stores?" the Primarch asked.
He knew the answer, but wanted to make sure that his commanders were abreast of every detail of the ship's running.
"Of no immediate concern, Lord," replied Agapito.
Bran and Solaro made up the quartet, with Aloni on watch command at the strategium.
"The Avenger was stocked for a full 3-year tour, more than enough for our current needs."
"The navigators are reporting the same difficulties as before," added Bran. "It'll be at least another 40 days until we reach the Sol system. They have requested that we make another real space drop to confirm our location."
"They are guessing," said Korax, sighing. "The rising warp storms almost blot out the Astronomicum. We've translated 3 times already, and every time we have been at least 5 light-years off course."
"Do you think that the rebels have something to do with the warp storms?" asked Agapito. "Is that possible?"
"I would not rule out anything at the moment," said Korax.
He knew more about the strange ways of the warp than the commanders with him, and it was not unreasonable to assume that Horus might have acquired some form of technology or other power that had allowed him to conjure the roiling tempest befouling the Immaterium. The nature of what that other power might be, the hints he had learned from the Emperor and gleaned from his fellow Primarchs, was best not shared.
"There is the possibility that this turmoil hampers our enemies as much as it does us, but only a possibility. If it is not impertinent to ask, Lord, why are we heading for Terra?" asked Bran. "Although I can't begin to guess at the motives of the War Master, the treachery at Istvan suggests he wants to remove all opposition as swiftly as possible. Would it not be safer to secure deliverance against attack?"
"Horus might expect as much,"
said Korax, turning his back to the balustrade to face his commanders. There was a noise from below as the assembled legionaries finished their meals and began to pile up the empty platters.
"That is good enough reason not to go there. I have even stronger reasons for going to Terra."
The statement floated in the air for a while until Agapito realized it was up to him to ask the next question.
"Are you willing to share those reasons with us, Lord?"
"I must speak with the Emperor," replied Korax. "We do not know yet whether news of Horus's perfidy has reached the Imperial Palace. Surely the Emperor is gifted enough to know when such a tragedy has befallen his realm," said Bran.
"The warp storms may serve another purpose beyond stifling travel," said Korax.
He looked at his commanders, seeing confusion in their expressions.
"The warp, the navigators, the astropaths, and even the Emperor are linked together. They derive their powers from its energy, and so the storm cover might shield the Emperor's far-seeing gaze as much as it blinds the navigators to the route to Terra."
"Do you think Horus will attack the Emperor directly?" asked Solaro. "Does he plan to invade Terra?"
"Certainly," said Korax. "He has turned from the Imperial truth and must either destroy the Emperor or be destroyed. The War Master's actions have set us on a course to this confrontation. There can be no other outcome."
This was greeted with intakes of breath and thoughtful silence for a few moments. Korax sympathized with his subordinates. The magnitude of what Horus had done was difficult to comprehend.
"It seems Istvan will become Horus's folly," said Bran. "Even with the backing of so many legions and the blow he dealt at the drop site, he cannot hope to stand against the rest of the Imperium."
"We must assume the worst," said Solaro, before Korax could speak. "If those of the other legions, who we once trusted with our lives, can be turned, we can place no faith in the loyalty of the Mechanicum or the Imperial Army."
"You are right," said Korax. "We have no idea of the true strength of the rebels."
He stopped. The word rebels did not convey nearly enough the gravitas of what Horus and his conspirators had perpetrated.
"The traitors will have planned their moves for some time. Horus is prone to grand gestures, to displays of power, but he does not move without due preparation. Be sure of it.
He did not act until he was ready, and that must mean he sees now as his best chance of a swift victory.
It'll be up to us to deny him, of course, said Bran, lip curling with anger.
Of course, said Korax, smiling thinly. It is not in our foes' interests to see the Imperium destroyed. They look to usurp the Emperor and become the rulers of the galaxy. So they must act quickly, destroying the Emperor and those who will fight with him before the rest of the Imperium is dragged into the war. No matter what powers Horus has at his disposal, I agree with Bran. The traitors cannot win a long war.
The legionaries were filing out below, while more were entering from the open doors in the far wall. Dozens of serfs were clearing the tables and bringing out heaps of fresh rations for the new arrivals. Korax looked down, meeting the eyes of the Raven Guard looking up at their leader. There was a dreary defiance etched into the features of those passing below, a moroseness that the Primarch did not like.
Sergeant Nestil!
Korax called out, halting the squad leader. The sergeant stood transfixed for a moment, like a target seeing the glint of a weapon pointed in his direction.
Lord Korax? Nestor replied. How may I serve?
Why so glum, sergeant? Korax kept his tone light-hearted. Is the food not to your liking?
I have eaten better, I must admit, lord, said the sergeant.
I suspect Horus is sitting on a big pile of grog steaks, sergeant. When we have permission from the Emperor, we'll go and relieve him of them.
There was laughter from the gathered legionaries, a little thin, but better than the depression that Korax had sensed before.
Aye, lord, and no doubt Fulgrim has a few fancies too that we could help him with, replied Sergeant Nestil, earning more laughs.
You can be sure of that, Lankrotto. You can be sure, said Korax, laughing along with the poor joke.
The Primarch waved the legionaries on and turned his attention back to his commanders. His smile faded quickly.
We cannot allow the wounds of Istvan to fester, he told them. The Legion is depleted in strength, but it is the injuries to our spirit that are more grievous. We live or die by our successes, and they have been short of late.
We will fight to the last man, said Solaro.
Yes, said Korax.
His next words were to encourage himself as much as his companions.
Yet it would be better if we could get Horus's forces to do that instead. We need a victory, something to restore honor and prestige. If we hole up in deliverance, we surrender the initiative to our foes. That is not how we fight. With whatever force we can muster, we must take the fight to the traitors. We must prove to ourselves and others that they are not impervious, that an assault on Terra is not inevitable. At the moment, we have been dealt a harsh blow, but we cannot run forever. The sooner we turn and fight back, the sooner we will sow doubt amongst the traitors, and cracks will appear in their alliance.
Are you so sure they will be so easy to break apart, lord? Asked Agapito.
Korax started to walk along the gallery. The great arched windows to his right were shuttered with ribbed steel blocking the view of the warp outside, but he could still feel its presence, like an oppressive atmosphere, a tension that permeated everything. To think that it might be under the control of Horus in some way was disconcerting.
Easy? No, said Korax in reply to Agapito's question. Yet there will be disunity. Even under the banner of the Emperor, my brothers and I could find cause for argument. Horus may have the ears of some for now, but each seeks to profit in his own way from this rebellion. When it becomes clear that those goals will not be achieved without great effort, their resolve will wane and their common cause will fracture.
Let us hope we can bring that about, said Agapito.
Korax directed a stern stare at the commander, stopping just before the narrow doorway at the end of the gallery. Agapito wilted slightly under the Primarch's unforgiving gaze.
We have no room for hope, said Korax. We plan and we act. Hope is for dreamers and poets. We have our will and our weapons, and we shall dictate our own fate.
When Korax had departed, Bran, Agapito, and Solaro made their way back to the quarters they now shared.
Why did you mention hope, brother? Bran asked harshly. Do you not remember those same words he spoke at Gate 42? "It was just a turn of phrase, brother," said Agapito, clearly taken aback. "Of course I remember Gate 42. Who could forget that slaughter?"
"Be more careful with your words in the future," snapped Bran. "Lord Korax does not need any extra distractions at the moment."
Agapito looked as if he would argue, but then bowed his head, accepting the admonishment.
"As you say, brother," he said, "I will watch my words carefully in future."
Looking at the nearly empty jars in his small case, Palon wondered how much longer he could make the spices and herbs last. The Prefector had said nothing of the crude fare Palon had been forced to serve him of late. His breeding was far too good, and his military experience too long for such complaints, but it nagged at Palon's conscience that a noble of Therion should endure the same bland meals as a common serf. He had done his best to make Valerius's sparse quarters accommodating, setting out such belongings as the Prefector had brought aboard on the narrow shelves and bedside table. Valerius's full-dress uniform and parade regalia were hung on one wall, along with his gold-hilted power sword, but their bright appearance only highlighted the drab, unpainted bulkheads, rather than drawing the eye away from them. Palon had managed to procure a few paints and brushes from the ship's stores, not enough to liven up the whole chamber, but sufficient to add some colour to the plain furnishings and the bare tin plates and cups he had taken from the mess. The Raven Guard seemed to revel in their austerity, he had decided, embracing the harsh conditions of their home on Deliverance, instead of celebrating the luxuries and frivolities that should have come with compliance. The manservant had never thought he would miss those endless corridors of the old mines, or the empty vistas through the windows, but since coming on board the Avenger, he had come to see the time he had spent on the dusty moon as comparative opulence. He heard the outer door hissing open and finished his fussing around the small table he had set out for the Prefector's supper. Valerius came into the main chamber and sat down without comment, his eyes passing quickly over the carefully sliced protein slabs, dusted with chemer and orthol. The Prefector lifted the dented metal cup, its edge painted with a fine line of red by Palon, to his lips, but stopped before he took a sip. He lowered the cup to the table and finally looked at his manservant.
"I miss wine," said Valerius. "A nice carafe of Mastilian red, a glass of bubbly Narinith. For shame, I'd even settle for a sip of that stuff Prime Tribune Nathor rustled up on Hera Cygnus."
Palon said nothing. It was not his place to speak, but to listen. He had overstepped the mark before, back on Deliverance, and no end of trouble had come from it. With everything that had been going on, and he had overheard a lot from the Raven Guard and the crew about events that had taken place on Istvan, he was happy to be safe and able to concentrate on his sole duty of providing for the Prefector.
"Mustn't grumble, though, Palon," said Valerius, as if his servant was the one who had voiced the lament. "Latest estimate says we're just 12 days from translating into the Sol system. Though judging by their recent success rate, I'd not be surprised if the navigators took twice that time. It's exciting, though, isn't it? Terra, Palon, won't that be something of remark?"
Palon wasn't sure if he should reply or not. It was difficult sometimes to judge whether he was simply an ear for the Prefector to speak into, or if his master wanted to engage in conversation. Valerius did not continue, and had a look of expectation that suggested to Palon that he was waiting for a reply of some kind.
"I would never have thought I would see such a thing, master," Palon said dutifully. In truth, he had been exceptionally anxious about the upcoming stop at the centre of the Imperium. No doubt there would be all manner of dignitaries there to greet their arrival. It would be a shocking failure on Palon's part if Valerius turned up looking like some ragamuffin officer from one of the professional regiments, but he only had limited resources to launder and repair his master's uniform.
"It is an honour that I can scarce believe."
"You're not wrong about that," said Valerius,
plunging his fork into a piece of synth squash that Palon had artfully carved into a slim petalled flower. An hour's work was demolished in seconds by the Prefector's chewing.
"There are Lord Commanders of Therion who have not had the privilege."
"You seem to be of good mood today, master," said Palon, sitting at the end of the bed as he dared to venture his opinion.
"I have had a conclave with Korax and the Raven Guard Commanders, Palon," said Valerius between mouthfuls of food. "I fear our stay on Terra will be short-lived. As soon as I can secure passage, I am to travel back to Therion to entreat further forces.
With the losses the Legion has suffered, and the regrettable sacrifice of my own command, it is desired that I raise a new cohort to fight alongside Lord Korax against the traitors.
It is good that he would entrust such a duty to you, Master, said Palon.
He regretted his words as Valerius purposefully placed his knife and fork on the half-empty plate and turned a frown on the manservant.
Why ever would they not? Trust me.
I was not speaking of you in particular, Master, Palon said hurriedly. Trust has been in short supply of late, is all. Even I get wary glances from the crew as they see me about my business. Times such as these, it's good the Primarch has every faith in Therion to fight for the Emperor.
Yes, you're right, said Valerius, resuming his meal. He smiled through the laborious mastication of a faux grox fillet, his words coming as a mumble. It is quite an important duty. We'll need every able man and woman who can carry a lasgun. It'll be like the founding after compliance. Bigger, even.
The prefect had finished his supper, washed it down with his recycled water, and stood up.
Dark times, Palon, but aren't all great moments in history seeded in the dark? He said, kicking off his short boots and flopping onto the bed. Nobody remembers those who lived in times of joy and plenty.
Indeed not, Master, said Palon, collecting up the dishes and cup.
He stopped just before the door.
Will you need me for the next hour, Master? I've got some time in the laundries, is all.
No. I think I can be without you for an hour, said Valerius, sounding tired.
Palon glanced over his shoulder and saw the prefect's eyes were closed, his chest already rising and falling gently.
Perhaps a little more salt next time, the prefect murmured, his voice trailing away into sleep.
As you say, Master,
Palon said to himself with a smile of satisfaction, closing the door behind him.
133 days after departing from Istvan, the Avenger finally reached the Sol system, heart of the Imperium, birthplace of mankind. On Korax's orders, the ship came in and deployed its void shields immediately. It would be incautious to arrive without some form of protection, but using the reflex shield had the potential to invite immediate suspicion. The sensor reports were also flooding in, bringing with them a picture of a star system in considerable turmoil. Dozens of warships, haulers, and transports were moving back and forth from the lunar bases and Terra, navigating their way through layer after layer of minefields, orbital defense platforms, and out-system heavy monitors. More still were arriving. There was not an hour that passed without at least two or three ships breaking from warp. Word was spreading across the Imperium. The warp storms that had so hampered the Raven Guard on their journey also disrupted astro-telepathic communication. Even in the best of conditions, it took many weeks, sometimes several months, for messages to be relayed from the heart of the Imperium to its outer reaches. Add to this the violence of the warp tempest, and it could still be many months before some systems were even aware of the War Master's treachery. This was just the beginning, Korax sensed. Dozens of ships would become hundreds, thousands, perhaps. For the moment, Horus had the element of surprise, but the behemoth that was the Imperium was being roused to confront this new threat. The resources of the Emperor were vast, but ponderous. But once they had achieved a critical momentum, they would be unstoppable. Of this the Primarch was certain. Horus's only chance of triumph was a swift victory, and Korax would do all he could to ensure that such a thing would not happen. After the standard delays in bringing the scanners and communications arrays online after the warp transit, the Raven Guard found themselves being insistently hailed by the wrathful Vanguard, a strike cruiser of the Imperial Fists Legion. Captain Norris were threatening all manner of violence if they did not identify themselves. It was clear from Norris's hails that unexpected visitors were not welcome.
"This is the Avenger, battle barge of the Raven Guard," replied Bran, with Korax standing beside him. "We are carrying Lord Korax to Terra. Please ensure we have a clear path."
There was a delay before the Imperial Fist's communication returned. Even with audio-only exchanges, there was a noticeable time lag between message and response, indicating that the wrathful Vanguard was several hundred thousand kilometers away.
"You are not authorized to proceed. Power down your shields and prepare to receive a boarding party.
Failure to comply will be treated as an act of aggression, and you will be destroyed."
Korax laughed at this, but Bran was in no mood to bandy words with the Imperial Fists captain.
"Watch your tone, Captain. Lord Korax will be meeting the Emperor in person. If you have a problem with that, perhaps Rogel Dorne himself would like to come aboard and discuss it. If you have finished insulting my Primarch, provide us with escort to get us to Terra without further interference."
"I am not at liberty to indulge you, Primarch aboard or not," came Norris's terse reply. "All non-sanctioned vessels are to be inspected. If you have not noticed, one legionary's word to another doesn't count for much anymore. We will board, and if you refuse, your vessel will be destroyed."
His jaw clenching with anger, Bran reached for the transmit button, but he was stopped by Korax. The Primarch gently pushed the commander aside and bent down to the communications array.
"Captain Norris, your attention to duty and protocol is admirable," said the Primarch, his deep voice edged with humor. "I am more than happy to welcome a delegation from my brother's legion aboard, but please, dispense with the threats. This is a battle barge carrying several thousand legionaries. You have a strike cruiser with a complement of 50 legionaries."
More silence followed, longer than the previous pause.
"Please identify yourself."
Sighing, Korax shared a glance with the others around him before he activated the transmit switch.
"I am Lord Corvus Korax, Primarch of the Raven Guard, Savior of Deliverance, Commander of the 27th and 376th Expeditions, Acting Marshal of the Therian Cohort, and Lorded Conqueror of 1,000 Worlds. Please, come aboard, and I will show you my other credentials."
Static buzzed across the network for a while, until Norris had conceived a suitable reply.
"I will lead the boarding party, Lord Korax. Please, lower your shields in preparation."
Korax gave a nod to the technicians at the defense control station and stepped back from the communications panel.
"Be nice. He's only doing his duty," the Primarch told Bran. "The quicker we sort out this inspection, the sooner we can be on our way."
"Aye, but he doesn't have to be so stiff about it, does he?" said the commander.
"He's an Imperial Fist," replied Korax. "He can't help it."
Though he kept his tone light, the Primarch was wary. He was sure there was nothing on board the Avenger that would cause problems, but he had an instinctual aversion to close scrutiny. He suppressed his apprehensions and motioned for Bran to welcome Captain Norris.
The scraping of a rock chisel smuggled from the mine workings rang tinnily from the walls of the small cell. Rekwai sat in the corner of the room, whittling away at a lump of slag, the form of his latest creation not yet discernible. Corvus lay on the small mattress, listening intently to the old man with his eyes closed, his hands behind his head. It had been only 2 years since his discovery, 2 years of moving from prison block to prison block, while his body had grown to that of a 12-year-old. Rekwai was only the latest in a line of imprisoned dissidents and anti-establishment intellectuals who had learned of Corvus's existence and volunteered to teach the strange boy what they knew of people, politics and history. It was the one area Corvus really hadn't known anything about. His technical knowledge was vast, encapsulating the greatest scientific learning of mankind. Corvus could identify the molecular composition of the walls, the door and the bed. He knew the biological processes that had formed the cataracts in Rekwai's eyes. The old man had turned down Corvus's well-meant offer to surgically remove them, saying it would arouse suspicion in the guards. For all of that immense knowledge, Corvus knew little enough about people. It was as if his education had been cut short before that lesson had been learnt, leaving him bereft of the subtleties of human nature, a blank slate, waiting for more information to be written upon it. He was aware enough to know he was very naive in this regard, and his first tutor, Manrus Colseus, had swiftly exhausted his own store of wisdom concerning the human condition. So had begun the process of Corvus's education, hidden amongst the masses of the prison mine, that he now knew was called Lycaeus.
"That was the end of the third Phaeacian dynasty," Rekwai was saying.
Motes of detritus floated in the air and created a grey patch on the flagstone floor around the elderly agitator. His chisel continued its work, seemingly independent of his whitening eyes, which were fixed on a point somewhere near the dim light globe set in the ceiling.
With the usurpation by Neorthan Chandrapax, the first settlements began. Lotteries were held for the colonists, so great was the urge to leave Kiavar's smoke-ridden cities and polluted seas. In a way, it was the first time in 700 years that anything like a democracy was in effect. Regardless of station, every family was given equal chance to be crew on the ark boats being built. Of course, the higher-ups weren't being stupid. While everyone had an equal chance to participate, only the elite would be in charge as officers. The new colonies would have mayors from the old families, the college networks would still be in place, and the workers would still be the downtrodden in their new lives.
"Someone's coming,"
said Corvus, hearing beyond the walls the distinctive tramp of boots and the specific noise of the door at the far end of the corridor opening.
"Flash inspection."
"Quick, lad, you know what to do,"
said Rekwai, bounding to his feet with sprightly energy. Corvus rolled off the bed as Rekwai scattered the evidence of his hobby with a sweep of his foot. The old man stuffed the chisel and lump of slag into a pocket sewn into the bottom of the mattress, while Corvus moved aside the old tin bucket that served as a latrine. He could hear the clank of the locks being unwound from the main lever further down the corridor, and a moment later the latch on the cell door sprang open with a rusty screech. The door swung outwards on its spring, opening onto the brightly lit corridor, letting the thudding of the boots into the cell.
"I don't have to hide," said Corvus,
hesitating as he lifted up the slab that concealed the crawl space he had dug through the core rock beneath the prison block.
"I can only hear 6 of them. It wouldn't be any trouble to kill them."
"Oh, not trouble for you, for sure," said Rekwai, scowling. "But where there's 6, there's 6,000. Think you can take on all of them, do you?"
"I could try," said Corvus.
"Not yet, lad," said Rekwai. "Not till you know what's worth fighting for. Told you before, what you have is a gift, but it could be a curse, too. Got to be right when you kill a man. Got to mean something."
Corvus sighed and slipped into the dark space under the floor. He dragged the slab back into place and fumbled in the dark for the matches and candle stub. The youth did not really need them. There was enough light trickling through from the crack around the loosened slab for him to see perfectly, but Rekwai had provided them for Corvus's comfort, and he felt honour-bound to make use of them. As the candle flickered into life, its light gleamed from Rekwai's carvings that Corvus had placed on a narrow shelf that ran the length of the crawl space. There were all kinds of animals and birds, some complete, others just heads or faces. Each seemed a grotesque parody of the creatures locked inside Corvus's head, but Rekwai assured him that they were real, true-to-life representations of mutant creatures that dwelled in the slime pools, acid grottos and sprawling enzyme marshes of Kiavar. Corvus wondered much about this world. He had seen it several times through the armoplex windows on the transit galleries, like a red and blue eye glaring up at Lycaeus. Manrus had explained that Lycaeus was a prison on a moon orbiting Kiavar. The first prisoners had been sent here centuries ago for speaking out against the coronation of the Fourth Dynasty. Then the mineral deposits had been discovered, and more were found guilty of dissent and sentenced to work to death in the burgeoning mines. That much Corvus had understood, even if Manrus had spelled it out in no uncertain terms, that such political imprisonment was immoral. To remove one's enemies made sense to Corvus, especially if they could be turned to a more profitable endeavour. It was the condemnation of the families that Corvus had not fully understood. Again, he could perhaps justify the imprisonment of those related to the first agitators and demagogues, because there would be grounds to suspect a criminal's beliefs might be shared by those around him. What stretched Corvus's comprehension was the continued internment of those born and raised in the mines. The people of Lycaeus were no longer just prisoners. They were a colony of families and children whose entire lives would be spent in the stuffy, false atmosphere contained by the energy domes and mine works. No child could be accused of insurrection, surely. Manrus had explained carefully that Lycaeus was a prison only in name now. It was a slave factory, its purpose to provide resources for the great manufactories of the world below. That had made Corvus angry, especially when Manrus had revealed that only a few hundred members of the tech guilds, the descendants of the old colleges, benefited from the mass industrialization. Manrus considered this deeply unfair, and therefore so too did Corvus. Corvus listened to the guards above, shouting for the prisoners to stand in the corridor for inspection as he crawled along the narrow tunnel, admiring the skill with which each sculpture had been fashioned. Every feather, scale, and hair was rendered in fine detail, etched from the hard slag by that tip of chisel. The candle flame flickered slightly as someone moved across the false flag above. There was a strange hollow thump, and Corvus froze, realizing he had not replaced it properly. There was a confused exchange between the guards and two further stamps on the offending slab. Corvus blew out the light and retreated to the far end of the hideaway, some 3 meters from the entrance. There was a scraping noise as a knife was inserted into the narrow gap between the flag and its neighbors. Bunching his muscles, Corvus formed his hands into fists and bared his teeth, ready to slay those who would discover him. He must not be found. Over and over, from everyone through whose wardship he had passed, he had been told this: do not be found. He was an anomaly, something beyond the understanding of the Kievarans. If they discovered him, he would be taken away. Corvus did not want to be taken away. He had friends here, friends like Ephrania and Manrus and Requi. The slab lifted up, and the beam of a flashlight flickered around the tunnel mouth.
"What have we here?"
said one of the guards, ducking his head into the opening. Corvus shrank back as far as he could, pressing himself against the jagged rock wall, eyes narrowed. The beam of the torch moved towards him and stopped when it reached the shelf of sculptures.
"Seems Requi has been up to his scrimshawing again," said the guard.
Corvus did not detect much malice in the man's tone.
"Leave it be," said another voice from above. "It does no harm. More paperwork for us if we report it."
"I dunno," said the guard, squatting above the hole. "It is contraband, and if someone else finds it, we'll be up for penal shifts, or worse. Let me see."
The guard moved away, and his helmeted head was replaced by another, this time with a silver strip across the nose guard that signified a wing corporal. He flashed the torch around some more, the beam of light coming to rest directly on Corvus. The youth tensed every muscle, ready to leap forwards and tear off the corporal's head the moment he tried to raise the alarm. To Corvus's amazement, the corporal said nothing. He played the flashlight around the tunnel for a few more seconds, its beam twice more moving slowly over Corvus, then stood up.
"You're right," said the wing corporal. "Not worth reporting that. We'll get him to hand over whatever he's using as a tool. Might use it as a weapon otherwise."
The slab slammed down with a ring that shook Corvus. He squatted, panting in the dark, unable to work out why he had not been discovered. Eventually the boots thudded away, and the door creaked shut again. There was a gentle rap on the concealing slab.
"You still down there, lad?"
With a laugh of relief, Corvus crawled to the slab and pushed it up, glad to see Requi's perplexed, bearded face.
"Still here," said Corvus.
"I thought they'd find you for sure," said Requi, helping Corvus up through the hole, though the youth needed no such aid.
"I swear they was looking right down there."
"They did," said Corvus. "They didn't see me. How's that possible?"
Requi shook his head and slumped onto the mattress while Corvus replaced the slab, this time ensuring it fit as snugly as possible.
"How's anything possible where you're concerned?" said the old inmate. "How is it possible a baby boy's found a kilometre deep inside a glacier? How is it possible he pulls off the head of a grown man? How is it possible he ages 5 times faster than any other folk? There's all sorts that's possible when we're talking about you."
"They looked right at me and didn't see me."
The possibilities were flashing through Corvus's mind. He thought now how wonderful it would be to travel the wings without concern, moving from one block to the next without the guards ever noticing him. Deep inside himself, from some place of instinct rather than intellect, he knew this was something he could do. Like all of the other gifts he had been given, this was an ability that was meant to be used, though to what purpose he was still not sure.
It was nice of the guards not to take your sculptures, said Corvus, bringing himself back to the present.
Nice, my arse, said Requi. That corporal gave me a truncheon in the gut before he left. They're all bastards, lad. Never forget that.
I won't, said Corvus. They're all bastards. Don't worry, Requi. One day we'll be settling the score.
Requi smiled and leaned forwards, gesturing for Corvus to sit beside him. He placed a wiry arm across the boy's shoulders and gave him a hug.
Sure enough, lad, said the inmate. A few more years, you'll have to be patient. A few more years, and you'll be ready. You'll make the bastards pay. No doubt about it.
Corvus smiled at the thought.
True to his word, Korax met with the arriving Imperial Fists, accompanied by his senior officers and company captains. Norris arrived with a full complement of legionaries, who disembarked from the Stormbirds in the docking bay and formed a guard of honour for their captain. Norris appeared last, crested helmet under one arm, a long cloak of scarlet trailing from his armour. He seemed very young for a captain to Korax's eye, his head covered in a short-cropped nest of blonde curls, bright blue eyes fixing immediately upon the Primarch. The captain swallowed hard and continued to stare at Korax.
"Is there something amiss, Captain?" asked the Primarch.
"Not at all," said Norris. "We did not expect to encounter Raven Guard, much less yourself, Primarch."
"And why would that be?"
Norris's discomfort increased.
"We have received word that you're all dead," he said quietly. "The Raven Guard, Salamanders and Iron Hands, we, that is Legion Command, were told that there had been no survivors from Istvan."
"I am pleased to contradict such rumours in person," said Korax. "As you can see, the Raven Guard continue to serve the Emperor."
The captain said nothing in reply. Korax realized that Norris had to consider an alternative explanation for the Raven Guard's survival, that they were loyal to Horus.
"I understand your suspicions, Captain," said the Primarch. "When so few have survived such treachery, it is hard to believe we did so without collusion. I would assuage your doubts in any way that I can. Whatever assurances you require, we will provide them."
"My apologies for this necessary inspection, Primarch," said Norris, eyes averted. "I am under standing orders to conduct a search of every vessel entering this quadrant without authorization."
"The Raven Guard will cooperate in any way we can," replied Korax. "We understand well the need for security at this time. What do you require of us?"
Norris looked along the line of Raven Guard officers, a row of scarred faces regarding him with distaste bordering on hostility. He sought sanctuary in the more welcoming expression of Korax.
"We are ordered to conduct a thorough search of the ship and all personnel aboard, Primarch."
He glanced back at his legionaries.
"We shall conduct our investigation in 10 teams, if that is possible. If you would appoint a liaison officer, I can brief him on the details of the process."
"I do not wish to be delayed, Captain," said Korax. "I am on my way to an audience with the Emperor."
"I am sure that with your cooperation, we can be thorough and efficient, Primarch," said Norris. "It should take no longer than a couple of days."
"Very well," said Korax, though the thought of being kept here for any longer irked the Primarch. He pointed to Bran. "Commander Bran is captain of this vessel. You may conduct all communication through him. He will make other officers available to assist your inspection. All holds, bays, storage areas, weapon lockers and barracks will be open to your men. I shall have my legion prepared for the inspection."
"Thank you, Primarch," said Norris.
He looked as though he was about to say something else, but stopped himself. Korax was not sure, but he had the sense that Norris had wanted to offer more than just gratitude. Sympathy, perhaps.
"We will begin our inspection immediately."